once, soon after they started dating a few years earlier, that he'd found his father's body back in Merrow's Ravine, where the man had shot himself when my dad was just 16. He'd called out for my mother to come to him then, made a wish and hoped she heard it all the way in Lilydale, where she did hear it, and later came to him when he needed her comfort. "It's not important," my mother had said when he asked where she'd come from, though, not wanting to remind him. "I'm here," she said now. "Here is where I am." My dad beamed. She'd gone away that summer with their fate clasped within her hands. Said she needed time to think about the two of them, what they were doing together, whether they should stay that way forever. He'd argued, he'd railed against her, but she'd left anyway, secretly carrying their child within her, not wanting him to know until she was sure of what she wanted. Here she was now, telling him she wanted him. He stepped down from the porch to go to her then, and my mom moved toward him. When they came to stand on the front lawn beneath the shadows of the maples, they took each other's hands. My dad leaned down to kiss her, but my mother stopped him, put a hand on his lips. "Wait," she said. "There are things I need to tell you." And because she told him bits and pieces of the future that had come true in the past, because my dad trusted her to know things he couldn't ever know of, he stopped and waited for her to continue. "There will be three," she said. She took her hands from his and put them on her stomach, then looked up into his eyes again, hoping he would understand. "There will be three children, and we won't be able to protect any of them." "No one can do that anyway," my dad said, bold and foolish. "No one can protect their children from everything." I stood apart from them, watching in the dark, trying to understand them, trying to understand myself through them somehow. If ever I'd had the chance to unravel my own life, to give it back like an unwanted gift, this was the moment to do it. I could change things if I wanted. I could do what I'd seen my mother's father do. I could say the words to bend reality, to make myself grow backward, to become younger and younger and younger until I disappeared inside my mother and reduced myself to the atoms that I'd begun as, and then reduced myself to nothing, winking out of existence, as if I had never been. Or I could make myself visible to them, interrupt this moment. I could reveal their future to them, the whole thing, the big picture, our future as a family. I could warn them. I could say, "Don't do this. Her father is right. You will do and say terrible things to each other. You will involve your children in the messes your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents made. You will bury your first child when he's 5 years old, and you'll die too young yourselves. It's not worth it. I'm not worth it. Please, don't do this." If I slipped out of the shadows of time and space to reveal myself and tell them all the things that would happen when they trusted their hearts to lead them forward, I could take up this knot in our shared history and undo it. I could unmake the curse by unmaking our lives together. But I didn't move. I waited for another moment, and then another. And then I closed my mouth, put my hand over it, shaking, frightened that I'd almost said something I could never take back, the way my mother's father had done in the orchard. Even with the burden of our history, I wanted this life, I realized. This one. Not someone else's. I wanted mine. My father leaned down to kiss my mother beneath the moonlight then, and that was when it happened. They began to bring us, my brothers and me, out of the ether of possibility and into the world. When I opened my eyes back in Lilydale, I found a vault of stars spiraling overhead. Night had fallen around me. And when I looked for the star my mother had said would lead me home if I was ever lost, the one she'd used to take her back to my father in Temperance, it was still there, up in the sky, still blinking. The probable stone. From the surrounding leafy shadows, Carolyn stepped forward, and the blue light of the moon washed over her face, making her look like a ghost in the forest. So, she said, did you find the answers you were looking for? I found something, I said, nodding. But I missed my chance to save everyone. Well, Carolyn said, you may not have to be the one to save everyone. What do you mean? Now that you've seen the truth, she said, the truth can see you. The story your mother told can no longer be believed. Now that you know the truth, now that you see everything, the curse can now see you. It can find you. And it can find your brother.
Why did you let me see it then? I said, raising my voice a little.
I hadn't understood everything exactly that unraveling my mother's story would mean.
I thought you were trying to help me.
I am helping you, Carolyn said. You've undone your mother's story. And now you and everyone she bound to it can see things clearly. Remember, your grandfather could see the future clearer than anyone. Clearer than your mother. Clearer even than you. He saw all of this coming to pass beyond the time he'd be able to do anything to fix it. He saw your mother's story unraveling because her son would fall in love with a young man who didn't fit into her story. A young man who knew it wasn't the truth because she'd forgotten to write him into it. The way she wrote the entire town into it. And he saw how that would be her story's undoing. He knew something would have to be done to save you. And he prepared me to help you see the truth, even though it would endanger you.
But why?
So that your mother would do what must be done now, Carolyn said. What she promised she would do a long time ago, if she couldn't figure out another way. The only thing that can undo the curse he made. I didn't like what I was hearing, and wasn't sure I wanted to know anything more than what I'd already discovered. But I asked the question anyway.
What? What does she have to do now?
Carolyn had stopped smiling as she explained things, and before she answered my question, she frowned. Your mother must walk Ava out of this world and into the next one, she said. She must take the curse with her. Your mother can't keep telling this story forever, trying to make you invisible to the eye of the curse. If she dies without walking Ava and the curse out of the world, her story will die with her, and the curse will eventually find you.
If that's the solution, I said, then why hasn't she already done it?
Because, Carolyn said, raising her silvery white brows in shock that I didn't yet fully understand. In order to walk Ava out of this world and into the next one, your mother must give up her own life.
Blackness, then. Blackness, and a painful howl of rage and desperation filled me. I'm not sure how long it consumed me, but when I returned to myself, I was running through the front door of Carolyn's house, running through the rooms out of breath, shaking, until I found Jared. He was in my room, waiting for me under the angel painting, asleep, one arm thrown over his forehead.
What's wrong? He asked when I burst in, startling him awake.
It's my mom, I said breathless. She's going to do something terrible.
What?
Jared asked. I melted into his arms as he stood to hold me and kept me standing. When I could, I pulled away and told him what I'd seen in the woods. She's going to give herself up for my brother and me, I said.
Jared's face twisted with confusion.
How? He asked. When?
Before I could say anything, though, Carolyn answered. Behind me, she said, if everything your grandfather told me years ago is still true, then she has already done it. She looked at the clock on the desk in my room. It was 5 in the morning, and I hadn't even realized it. I'd been out in the woods for half a day and an entire night, traveling through the world's shadow to find the truth of my family, and here it was. My family would soon be just me and Toby. Unless I did something. Unless I found another way to change things.
Are you telling your own story? Carolyn asked when she saw the idea in my eyes.
or are you being told?
They were my mother's words, the trick she'd taught me years ago to outwit death, after I'd witnessed a red-bearded man come into my seventh-grade classroom in his black suit and wide-rimmed black hat, to look my teacher up and down like he was a cow going to slaughter.
One day death will pay you a visit, my mother had said. But if you can tell the story of your life before death tells its version, if you can tell it true, you can maybe keep on living.
Mr. Marsdale didn't tell death his story? I'd asked.
He might not have known that he could, my mother answered. He might not have known how to. Most people don't know that trick anymore.
She had looked at me then, and it seemed as if a breath she'd been holding was suddenly released, filling the room with the scent of peppermint and coffee.
Now you know, she said, and you can use that trick one day if you want to. But the thing is, you have to tell your story true, and not everyone can do that.
Why not? I'd asked.
Because, my mother said, telling the truth is the hardest thing a person can do.
The teller shapes the story, Carolyn said from the doorway. If you don't tell it, the story shapes you.
I turned to Jared. We have to go right now, I said. I have to help her.
But it'll take at least 2 hours to get back to Temperance.
No, I said. There's another way.
Do you trust me?
And Jared said,
you know it.
Outside, the sky was beginning to pale, but the stars still winked weakly. There were only a few minutes left, I figured, before I'd see a red line grow on the horizon, and then the stars and the moon would disappear. So I stepped off the porch, pulling Jared behind me, and ran out into the middle of the road, where all of the tiny cottages of Lilydale blinked their eyes in the sleepy hours of early morning, and there I reached a hand up to touch the place where my mother had pinned a spell to the sky. As I raised a finger to the star, I found that I could feel it, warm and soft, thrumming with life and energy. Energy my mother had made, shaped into this form. Energy she had placed in the sky for safekeeping.
This is my home, and I know it, I said, reciting the rhyme my mother taught me when I was little. Even if I go away, it'll still be here. If I lose my way, it's your job to show it.
I pressed my finger against the star a second time, a third, and then the air around us began to shimmer. The probable stone glowed brighter, then grew larger, and finally it began to lower itself from the sky until it stood in front of me, changing its shape so that it looked like an open door filled with white light. I looked back at Carolyn, who was already raising her hand to wave goodbye. I nodded at her, and when I looked back at Jared, I said, "Are you ready?"
"Always," he said, "if it's with you."
So we stepped on through. Chapter 16. Homecoming. And came out on the other side, at the end of the long gravel drive of my house back in Temperance, where Jared had met me 2 days before, blocking me from going to Lilydale without him. All of the windows were still dark as the last smudge of night began to disappear from the horizon, and a red glow from the rising sun hung over the back tree line. After Jared and I came closer to the house, we found light escaping around the edges of the blinds and the kitchen windows. Ordinarily, no light would be turned on until my mom woke and started fixing breakfast, but when I let us in the front door and we searched the first floor, she was nowhere in sight. And when I raced upstairs to her room, taking 2 steps at a time, I discovered that her bed had already been made. Or else it had never been slept in. Across the hall, Toby was still asleep. His chest rose and fell peacefully. If nothing had disturbed him the night before, I thought maybe my mom had figured out some other way to walk Ava out of the world. Or else Carolyn had been wrong, and maybe Jared and I could have driven back home after all. Maybe I didn't need to talk my mom out of doing anything. "Toby," I said, trying to wake him. He'd know where she went, I figured,
and if he didn't know, he could help us look for her. But Toby didn't wake when I called his name. Not the first time, not the second. And when I went farther into his room and stood directly over him, when I shook him by his shoulders and called his name over and over, he still didn't wake up. That was when I knew that she'd done it after all. "What's wrong with him?" Jared asked from the doorway. I looked over my shoulder at him. "He's been put to sleep, I think." "What do you mean?" "My mom did something to him." It was clear to me then, too, that she didn't want anyone to get in the way of her plans. I went to Toby's window to look out at our property, sweeping from orchard to stream to pasture to cornfield to the woods at the back of the place, hoping to see her moving through the landscape somewhere. But the view offered me no answers. Our farm remained silent, asleep and dreaming. There would be no answers forthcoming, I knew then. Clearly she'd foreseen my coming back here, foreseen that I'd try to stop her. "I've always known what you were going to do before you did it," she told me before I left home. And it was true. She'd always seen our futures laid out like a map in front of her. There were gaps in her vision, of course, but she'd seen enough. More than I ever realized. None of that mattered now, though. I had to find her. Her trail would most likely be invisible, but I knew how to see invisible things, thanks to the eyes I'd been born with, the eyes my mother had given me. Now that her blindfold had been lifted, I could recall what it had felt like to interact with the invisible world when I was little, when it wasn't unnatural for me to see a spirit cross the railroad tracks on its way to wherever it was going, or to see a white stag slip between the trees down in Merrow's Ravine. And if my mother had tried to cover her trail so that I couldn't find her, I'd just have to go back to the moment she left here. I'd have to look for her in the world's shadow. I'd seen her do this. Return to the past by counting backward to the hour she wished to revisit. And by now I knew how to do that trick without even thinking my way through the steps. So I sat down on my bed, preparing to dream, like my brother was doing in the next room, but with a purpose. Jared pulled the chair from my desk and put it beside my bed, straddling it, his arms folded on top of the back, his head resting on his folded arms. "If you see me struggling with something," I told him, "don't wake me." "But what if you're in danger?" "If I need you to wake me, I'll squeeze your hand." "Here," I said, and slipped my palm into his. It was warm and only slightly rough-skinned from all of the training he'd been doing, but it felt solid because of that. And someone solid was what I needed. Then I lay down and began to count back through the minutes and back through the hours. Back and back and back I traveled. And as I counted, the events of the hours that had passed before my return whirred by like ghostly visitors. My mother putting the fire out in the downstairs fireplace, advising Toby to go to bed, reminding him that he had work in the morning. Toby going into his room to sleep later. My mother going in a while afterward, putting two fingertips on top of his eyelids to conjure some kind of deep sleep within him. And as the right moment arrived, when my mother walked down the staircase from her own room, pulling her arms into an old denim jacket she wore each springtime, I passed out of this world to join her in that last hour of that morning, right as she left the house, and under the remains of the moonlight, crossed over the railroad tie bridge into the orchard. When I opened my eyes again, I was in the orchard with her. The wind blew through the trees, making the few scraggly leaves that had opened up for spring whisper against one another. In the distance, the chimes on our front porch were ringing, and in front of me, my mother stood beneath the living death tree. With her back to me, she placed one hand on the trunk of the old tree and curled the other around the knotty rim of the hole at the top, where the tree began to branch outward. She was talking to the woman who lived in there, Ava. Ava Jablonski. Her grandmother. My great-grandmother. The woman who held her son's curse in the folds of her dress and wouldn't let go of it. I couldn't make out what my mother was saying, though. So quietly I moved forward. "There's no reason for it," my mother was saying. My sons have nothing to do with it. It's time to end this, Ava. Let it go. Please. Release it.
When no answer came from the tree, my mother changed her tone.
I've tried talking sense, and I've tried being patient. I've tried for years now. But these are my children. I've already lost one. And you've taken my husband from me, too. I won't let the others come to harm. If you force me to, I'll burn this tree down to its hateful roots.
With a threat in the air, Ava stepped from around the back of the tree, as if she'd only been hiding on the other side of it. She wore the same clothes I'd seen her wearing in the vision she'd shown me, a ragged dress with a babushka wrapped around her ruddy face. I knew she had probably been no more than in her early 30s when she died, but she looked more like an old woman. Her bare feet were covered with mud and bloody scratches from climbing through the living death tree's branches. But even in that wretched condition, she smiled briefly before she said,
"You cannot make me leave here, child."
And then she turned to pat the trunk of the tree like a sturdy horse.
"If you burn this tree, I will simply move into your house with you."
"You can't," my mother said. And there was no tone of family feeling in her voice. "You can't go beyond the creek without my permission. That land is mine by marriage, as this tree belongs to you by blood." Ava narrowed her eyes and wrung her hands in the folds of her dress a little, fingering what must have been the curse she clasped within it.
"Do you really think you can drive me away with fire?"
she asked my mother.
"I cannot burn, girl. And if this tree burns, it does not matter. I will find another. Will you burn them all down?"
My mother nodded, just once, firmly. "Yes," she answered. "You've twisted these trees beyond their lives anyway. Their fruits spoil even as they grow. Ava, we must end this. Now."
"I can stay without them," Ava said, frowning, pouting as though she thought my mother hadn't made her plans very carefully. She seemed to almost feel bad for her. "I do not need the things of this world to stay within it, my sweet one. One thing and one thing only keeps me here, and it will not let me go until it is finished."
She clutched the folds of her dress tighter then, clutched the place where she'd put her son's words, and shook it like a purse full of coins.
"These trees," she continued, looking around at them, shaking her head, closing her eyes sadly. "They do not matter."
"Old Black Suit is coming," my mother said fiercely, and Ava's eyes snapped open. "I saw him the other day, in fact. It's time again, you know, for you to deal with him. Or have you forgotten?"
"Why are you doing this?" Ava said, wincing.
A note of fear had crept into her voice. My mother was threatening her with something, and she seemed to actually feel threatened by it. But I didn't understand what my mom was using against her.
"I'm doing this to free you," my mother said.
"I'm doing this to free all of us." They looked at each other for a while after that, silent and serious. Finally, Ava said,
"It is not so easy, leaving after having stayed for so long. Do you know how it is?"
She shook the folds of her dress again, rattling the words inside. And this time she looked down at her skirt as though it were a chain locked around her body. When she looked up again, she said,
"I'm not sure I know the way to leave any longer."
My mom held her hand out to Ava then.
"I will take you where you need to go," she told her. "I know the way. It's not as far as you might think."
Ava stared at my mother's outstretched hand, hesitating. But in the end, she said,
"If you are willing to take me, then I must go with you. I know that rule, even though I forget so many others."
Then she reached across the space between them and took hold of my mother's hand. For a while they stared into each other's eyes, searching each other's face for the shared spirit between them. An old woman wearing a babushka who had saved her son's life, only for him to unwittingly curse the lives of her great-grandchildren,
and a middle-aged woman in a pair of jeans and a jean jacket that had belonged to her dead husband. And when they found what they were looking for, a glint of recognition behind both of their green eyes, they turned together and began to walk into the field behind the orchard, taking the lane beside Sugar Creek back to the woods. "She's in the ravine," I said, gasping for breath back in my bedroom as I swam up and out of the world's shadow. I said the words before I even had a chance to open my eyes. "The ravine?" Jared said. He was still sitting there beside me, holding my hand. "She's going to walk Ava out of this world," I told him. "And she paid their way across with her life to take Ava and the curse with her." I sat on my bed and shook my head, recalling what my mom had told me. "You'll be the one to find me," she'd said, "after I've passed out of this world." She knew this would happen. She'd been preparing me for this moment more than for any other in my life, even when I hadn't realized it. But she was leaving the choice to do something about it up to me. High school graduation would be just another day on a calendar, but this day, in her estimation, this day would be my first as an adult. I got up from my bed and left Jared behind me. "What are you doing?" he said as he stood to follow. At the door, I turned and said, "Please stay here and look after my brother until I come back." "But what are you going to do? Where are you going?" "I'm going back there," I said. "To Merrow's Ravine. I'm going to find her." It was a long walk. Longer than the walk I'd taken down to Merrow's Ravine to find my father's body that winter, it seemed. Each step was an effort. Each breath I took was a rusty blade cutting me open. The earth was soft beneath my feet, and I left a trail behind me, like the trail of my father's blood in the snow, the trail that had led me to the living death tree in the winter. Ava had somehow been behind his fall, probably because my mother's story had begun to unravel after Jared came home, picked up a loose thread of it, and started pulling. Pulling on me, pulling on my memories. I kept thinking that there was a chance to change things, that she'd be down there when I arrived, still alive, climbing up the side of the ravine, having found a way to return Ava without giving herself up in exchange. But when I made it to the edge of the ravine and looked down the slope to its bottom, all of those thoughts were ruined in an instant. My mother's body was down there, resting in a bed of early buttercups and daisies, in the same place my father's body had fallen. And I saw something, or someone, standing near her, casting a large shadow across her outstretched body. The wide brim of his hat rose before I saw anything else. And when I did see his face, it was the red strings of his scraggly beard I noticed first, and then his eyes, dark as coal, lined with veins of fire. He smiled when his eyes locked on mine, then put one hand on top of his hat and nodded, like he'd done when I was in the 7th grade, when he'd noticed I could see him. My heart started to beat faster, and a cold sweat broke out in beads across my skin, making me shiver in the chill morning air. I wanted to run back the way I'd come, back through the woods, beating branches aside, back through the lane and through the pasture, until I was home and could slip inside where I'd be safe. Or felt I could be safe, though there was nowhere truly safe anymore, and I knew it. There was no wish I could make that was strong enough to break the reality in front of me. There was no way I could get out of this without regretting it later. This was my only chance. You can't outrun death. But sometimes you can make him take off his hat to stay a while and listen. So I took a big breath and started to pick my way down the slope, to go to him, to meet him where he waited for me. I went slowly, hesitant to actually see my mom this way, up close, not breathing, her heartbeat flown away from her, and hesitant to be so near to the creature that had come into my classroom on the day he would take my teacher's life. Eventually, though, after stepping into the notches that the Lockwood men's feet had made in the side of Merrow's Ravine over the decades, I reached bottom. And there, in that place that held so much death in its embrace, I finally paused to return old Black Suit's nod.
I didn't smile, though. I didn't think I needed to be nice to him, just civil. We didn't say anything at first, and I decided to go to my mother's body, to attend to it however I could. Kneeling next to her, I saw that she was holding the silver pocket watch she'd had when she went into the world's shadow to end a blizzard. The watch her father had given her. The watch Lockwood had given Dobry after his mother had died for him. That watch was in my mother's hand, held against her chest, right where her heart should have been beating. Dawn light filtered through the canopy of trees above me, and when it fell onto the filigree around the watch, the silver gleamed. Tears sprang to my eyes as I uncurled my mom's fingers to take it from her. I wanted to hold it for just a moment, to feel the last heat of her touch on its surface. And when I slipped it away from her clenched fingers and opened the lid, the first thing I saw was the photo she'd put inside it. A picture of her and my dad on their wedding day. Both of them standing beneath an arbor grown over with roses. And under the glass of the watch itself, there was time, still being kept. Still ticking and ticking. But there was something else in there, too. Something I hadn't expected. We had time left, I remember her saying when we found my dad down here a few months earlier. I was saving it up. I had heaps and heaps of time saved for us. I saw something more in there, not just the gears of a watch moving. A golden flicker of light moved under the watch hands, like a goldfish swimming counterclockwise in a bowl of water. To others it might have seemed an illusion, but I knew it was true time. A way of saving up the seconds to stretch out a person's life by hours or days or years. It was no more than an extra hour, from the looks of it. But I knew my mother had kept this 1 hour back for me, had hidden it in there like a stash of money. There wasn't much left. Most likely, she'd been using whatever time she'd saved, sitting in front of the fireplace or her candle, trying to find my dad, using it to go back to the moment he died. Trying to understand the true nature of his death, trying to see what had been invisible to her, the trail of my father's blood that had led me to the living death tree in Sorrow Acre. This was what was left of the time she'd been using to bring him back to her. 1 solitary hour. It might be just enough, I thought, to turn back the clock and let her heartbeat return for a moment, if I wasn't too late. I wiped away a tear and looked up at the man in the black suit. He was looking down at me where I knelt beside my mother's body with a face full of infinite patience. He had time, after all. He had all the time in the world. "Well," he said, and his voice was low. He didn't sound particularly thrilled or excited by his task, as I'd imagined he would be when I was a kid. "The child who saw me." "I knew you saw me that day," I whispered. "I knew it."
"I see those who see me," he said, spreading his hands. "Most often it's the dying, but sometimes it's a little boy who can't help it. You have your mother's eyes, you know."
"She gave them to me," I said proudly.
"A great burden," Death's agent said, shaking his head as though he sympathized with me.
"Or a blessing," I said. "It can also be a blessing, depending on your view of things."
"Your brother once told me the same thing."
"Seth?" I said. And the man in the black suit nodded.
"Yes," he said. "He was a sage child, that one. He saw far too much for his own good."
"Like what?" I said, chilled by his words. They were the same ones my mother had said whenever she talked about Seth.
"He saw Ava," Old Blacksuit said. "He heard her voice, like you did. This was before your mother truly understood that her father was right. That Ava would never let go of the curse. This was before your mother decided to tell a story so that Ava couldn't reach you. So that the curse couldn't find you."
"The curse," I said. An Old Blacksuit nodded once more. Then he waved one of his arms to the side like a showman, and from behind him,
a small child came to stand beside him. It was the boy in the photo in my living room. It was Seth. It was my older brother. The brother who had died before I was even born. He was quiet as he stood there, looking up at me with innocent eyes, wearing what was most likely the little suit he'd been buried in. I blinked and blinked again, and my breathing quickened as Seth reached up with his tiny hand to grasp hold of Old Black Suit's outstretched fingers.
"Go ahead," Old Black Suit told the boy. "You can show him."
Seth looked back at me then, his green eyes seeming to glow a little, and a vision appeared between us. It was a vision of Seth, waking up in the early hours of the morning after hearing a voice call his name. The voice from the living death tree. The voice of Ava Jablonski.
"Seth," she called to him. "Seth Lockwood."
And Seth had risen from his bed to follow the trail of her voice, until he came to the old tree in the orchard, where she showed him what his great-grandfather had done to her. She showed him the day that she'd picked the orchard clean to save her son. She showed him the day she died in the very tree Seth stood under. And then she had stepped from behind the tree itself, curling her finger for Seth to come to her.
"I have something else to show you," she told him.
The same thing she'd said to me once, before my mother interrupted her. And Seth, curious, innocent, went to her. And it was then that she crouched beside his small frame and undid the knot in her dress, where the curse throbbed in its folds, hot and white and blinding in its ferocity. Ava spread her dress so that she could show the child the curse, reveal his fate to him, show him the truth that would consume his life in an instant. It was blindingly bright once placed before him. So bright. So bright. Bursting and popping with hate. It was then, looking down at it, that Seth fell backward and began to shake, to convulse, to turn blue, to stop breathing. My parents discovered him an hour later, his face lifeless, after they'd woken and found his room empty and begun to search for him. The vision faded then, but Seth still stood before me, clutching the hand of Old Black Suit.
"You can go if you want, child," Old Black Suit said.
And Seth nodded. Looking at me for a moment, he waved his small hand in a polite fashion, then retreated to his place behind Old Black Suit's coat and was gone from sight again. I felt tears, hot and burning, well up in my eyes as Seth retreated from me. A moment later, one rolled down my cheek, and quickly I raised the back of my hand to my eyes to wipe away any others before Old Black Suit could see what he'd done to me by showing me my brother.
"It isn't fair," I said after he'd left us.
"Life," said Death's agent, "isn't very fair to anyone, now is it?"
"No," I said. "It's not life that's unfair. It's death. Death is unfair."
"You are quite mistaken," the man in the black suit said,
looking almost insulted.
"I give many chances, over and over, to people whom I could easily take in a moment."
"You haven't been fair to my family," I said. "You might have turned away those people I love, those people Ava brought you."
"Why don't you tell me about all of this?"
Old Black Suit replied, as if he knew nothing of what I was speaking about. He looked around, and finding an old fallen tree nearby, sat down with his big hands draped over his knees.
"I like a good story," he said. "And your mother's family have always been good storytellers."
"Why, your great-grandmother Ava kept herself alive for many years by telling me stories."
"Your father's family, though? Not so good at this, I'm afraid. How far, I wonder, has the apple fallen, and from which tree?"
"Everything," I said, before I could think about what I was doing. "I'll tell all of it. Even the things my mother said others wouldn't understand. Like the living death tree of Sorrow Acre, and how I came to discover I'd been cursed or blessed with visions even my mother couldn't keep from me.
I'll tell you about how the white stag haunts my father's family, the way you haunt my mother's. I'll tell you all of these things and more. I'll tell you the secrets of my heart, the things that are invisible to even you, if you'll make a deal with me. The man in the black suit raised his red eyebrows, and a corner of his mouth twitched just a little, barely enough for a person to see he was grinning.
"If you think I'm here to carry you out of the world, you needn't worry," he said, waving my proposition away like a fly. "It's for your mother and great-grandmother that I came today. Your mother also made a bargain with me. This bargain, actually."
He looked at her as if the evidence of her body explained everything.
"A bargain to pay the way across for the two of them, and to take away the burden Eva carried."
"I'm prepared to make a different bargain," I said. And he raised his brows even higher, doubting my words. "My story for my mother's life. There's an hour left in this watch before she is yours to take. And if you'll agree to bring her back, I'll tell you everything." Old Blacksuit threw his head back and laughed at me. But when I didn't join him, when he noticed my straight face, he quieted down and looked at me with narrowed eyes. Scratching his stringy red beard, he took some time to consider my offer. And finally he said,
"If you tell me your story now, you will not be able to tell it again later, when it's you I've come for."
"I understand that," I said. Then, after adjusting the tilt of his hat, he nodded.
"Go on, then," Old Blacksuit said, settling in to listen.
And I began telling stories. Chapter 17. Paper People. Here's the thing. We're all as thin as paper. Like those paper people you used to find in children's magazines, inhabiting a two-page spread with other paper people, all of them hanging out somewhere together. At the park, at church, at school, at the mall, in the family room. Until some kid took a pair of scissors to the dotted lines surrounding them and cut them out of their paper world. That's us. That's anyone. That was me. A cut-out paper person removed from the world I once belonged to. Until someone called my name, and I turned toward him, leaving my life in paper behind me. That was how my story began. That was how I began, really. Before that moment when Jared called and I turned to him, it was like my life was this object that had been packed away in bubble wrap. And even though it was a safe enough life, it was no life at all, really. I moved through the world like a ghost, invisible to the people around me. I wasn't an athlete like my brother or father, and I wasn't charming, witty, or artistic, though I did have a talent for making my mom laugh at things. I was a decent student, even though I did tend to daydream during classes. But basically, yeah, there was nothing to me. Or so it seemed. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. There was more to me, actually, than I'd ever dreamed. What happened down in Merrow's Ravine that day in early spring is the story I'm telling. It's about this young guy, 17 years old, who falls in love with the best friend he's forgotten. It's about this son whose mother has made him forget parts of his own life in order to protect him. It's about a family and their secrets. It's about curses and how a story can change the world depending on how you tell it. It's about a mother who sacrificed herself for her son, and a son who told his story to save his mother. Which I managed to do, though just barely. Old Blacksuit, after all, is a finicky listener, having been around so long and having seen as much as he has. I have no illusions. I realized that some of the things I told Old Blacksuit that day were probably pretty mundane for someone like him. Old Blacksuit doesn't have any interest in seeing or hearing about high school or marriage or babies or any of the memories we've all been told to retain. Old Black Suit is interested in our invisible moments. The unnoticed gestures and forgotten conversations. The unlikely incidents and the dying light of abandoned places. The conflicts that evaporate from memory once they're resolved. The people we have no idea are important and no way of understanding why until it's all over. The last page turned. The story finished. Then it all goes away. Everything. Except for my mother, who returned. He brought her back to me after I finished my story, after I'd spent the last flicker of a golden hour my mom had saved. Right there, in the bed of buttercups and daisies, my mother's eyes fluttered open, and she gasped a breath that sounded like it was the first she'd ever taken. And when she'd gotten her bearings and was able to sit up and see me waiting there next to her, holding her hand, the first thing she did was shake her head as if she was amazed by everything her eyes were seeing. "You are so brave, Aiden Lockwood," she told me, after she'd had a chance to look around, to accept the reality of her return. "You are so brave, my son." I didn't think I was as brave as she was. I mean, it wasn't like I'd gone to death and back, like she had. But I got what she was saying, and I appreciated the fact that she could look at me and see me and tell me that. It kind of made me embarrassed, actually, to be called brave, when for most of my life, or at least most of the life I'd been able to recall for a long time, I'd been nothing. Just this kid who went to school and roamed the hallways, took his classes, got good grades, and had nothing, nothing, nothing of any importance to say to anyone. I had to start getting used to being me again, now that I was returning to myself, my real self, whoever that was. And maybe, I guess, brave was one of the things I was. Or it was one of the things I could be. "Come on," I said, and held up my hand to help my mother stand. She hugged me for a while afterward, rocking me in her arms like I was still the little boy she'd taken outside one summer to show the constellations only she could see. And after she hugged me, after she pulled away, wiping the tears from her eyes, we quietly climbed out of Marrow's Ravine. We made our way back through the woods, back through the lane, back through the pasture, taking our time, because in all honesty, we were both exhausted. And when we found ourselves at the back door of our house, my mom stopped to look up at it and to say, "I used to see the Lockwood house from the bus on my way to and from school every day when I was just a girl. I was drawn here. Sometimes I think I fell in love with this place before I fell in love with your father." I didn't say anything to that. I just looked up at our house with her, seeing it. I mean really seeing it, almost for the first time. Admiring it a little even, like my mom was doing. There was history in those rooms and hallways. My history. And I'd never understood that before. After we went in, the first thing I did was to go upstairs to look for Jared. I found him still sitting in a chair next to my brother, who was just then waking up from the heavy sleep my mother had weighed him down with. "It was all a bad dream," I said before Toby could shake the cobwebs from his head and ask where I'd gone, and why Jared was sitting in his room with him. Then I grabbed Jared's hand and pulled him out of there and into my own room, where we stretched out on my bed and fell asleep together, even though my door was open and anyone who passed by could see us in there, holding on to each other like it was the most ordinary thing in the world. It was a long sleep, and much needed, for me at least. When I woke, Jared was gone, leaving me curled around the empty space where he'd slept beside me. It was light out, and I could hear voices coming up from the kitchen through the vents. Above me, the crack in the ceiling that threatened to split my room apart was still there, but I didn't pay it any attention. Instead, I rolled out of bed and went downstairs to find my mom and Jared sitting at the kitchen table, talking. When I came into the room, they stopped and looked at me. "There you are," my mother said, as if this were any other morning, even though when I looked at the clock on the wall, I saw it was already 2 in the afternoon. Not morning at all, and not an ordinary hour for me to be waking.
Where's Toby? I asked.
At work, my mom answered. I blinked, speechless, because going to work seemed like something too normal to do on a day like this one. But Toby had slept through everything because of my mom, so for him it must have felt like the exactly right thing to do, like today was, in fact, just like any other. After I sat down to join in on the coffee, my mother caught me up on her and Jared's conversation. She said that a whole lot had happened, and none of it easy to explain, and that she thought we should probably keep it a secret between just the three of us.
To spare Toby, she said. We've had a lot to deal with, and there's too much he doesn't know about. Where would we even begin?
I don't think we should do that, I said. And my mom tilted her head and asked why not.
I'm tired of secrets, I told her. My whole life feels like it's been one big secret for too long already. I don't want to live that way anymore. I don't want to do that to Toby. I don't want to do that to me and Jared either.
I looked over at Jared after I said that, and reached across the table with my hand palm up. And right there in front of my mom, he took hold of it, squeezing back gently. My mother's cheeks flushed a little, and she looked down into her cup of coffee. I could tell that I'd embarrassed her by reminding her of how she'd done that very same thing to me. Made me forget things. Left me clueless. And look where it got you, I wanted to say. I didn't, though. Jared was there. And being corrected by your youngest son in front of another person can't feel good. So I just said, I don't know where we'll begin either. But we should tell him, somehow. We'll figure out a way to do it if we try. My mom straightened her head. Her lips pursed resolutely and nodded.
You're right, she said. We'll figure out how to tell him the truth.
Didn't I always say it was the hardest thing for a person to do? Jared and I took a bus to Lilydale a few days later to retrieve the blue bomb. Without it, we were both stuck taking the school bus, which was incredibly lame, especially for seniors who were graduating in a month. On the way up, Jared held my hand, and for a while I felt a little afraid, like someone might see us, and I was just then getting used to our being together that way in front of my family. But then, when some people on the bus obviously did see us and didn't do or say anything, didn't even make a face like I expected, I let myself sink down in my seat with his hand in my lap and looked out the window at the passing scenery. There were these brittle pine trees greening under the sunlight and this almost crayon yellow sun above. And the sky was so blue, watercolor blue, with white scarf-like clouds soaring through it. Everything about us was entirely normal, really. We were as ordinary as anything we might come across in this world. Maybe Jared's father wouldn't see things that way. And sure, there were probably a lot of other people who would see things the way his father might. But what other people saw wasn't necessarily the truth. And in the end, it was the one truly and totally not normal thing about me, the kind of sight I'd been born with, that helped me to understand and forgive the people who couldn't look at Jared and me and see us for who we were. Just two people in love. When I looked at other people now, I could see how so many of them were wearing blindfolds like the one my mom had put on me. I could see how so many of them had damaged vision, how they couldn't see things clearly, how they saw only the stories other people had told them. And understanding how all of that worked now, I started to even feel bad for them a little. Carolyn was happy to see us again, and we stayed overnight in the angel and fairy-infested house once more, to tell her about what had happened after we left her. I promised her that I'd bring my mother up for a visit soon, now that my mom, too, was released from the constraints of her own story. "Please do that," Carolyn said. She told me to remember to tell my mom something else, that time, however much of it exists in the universe, does eventually run out for everyone. There was only 1 month of school left. And even though I thought it was way too late to become the kind of guy who suddenly makes friends with everyone at the end of the movie, I decided I also wasn't going to go back to being invisible. So when I saw Jared in the hallways at school, I'd meet him with an open smile. Or I'd make fun of his hair being too long, because he was constantly having to brush it out of his eyes. He was the starting pitcher. The coach, as he'd expected, wasn't willing to let someone with Jared's talent go just because he'd missed a couple of practices. And he was earning his keep, with two no-hitters already on his scorecard for the season. Sometimes, during breaks between classes, Jared would lean against the locker next to mine as I put books away or got out new ones, and he'd reach over to hold my door open, wanting to be near me. Before, I probably would have flinched, worried that he'd give us away. But now I'd just close my locker and lean back against it with him, our shoulders touching, watching everyone go by like a parade that didn't know it was a parade. I was keeping hold of all of the details as I experienced them. I was committing them all to memory. I was going to store up everything I could. I was going to savor all of the moments as I save them for the future. Because here's the thing. Death does come for everything. But death can also be bargained with, if you know how to strike a deal. Death likes to hear true stories, and I traded my own to save my mother's life. Old Blacksuit had warned me that if I did so, I wouldn't be able to tell him my story when he eventually came to claim me. I nodded, acknowledging that I understood, and handed my story over to him anyway. But there was something in our deal that the man in the black suit hadn't considered. The fact that all of us lead more than one life in our lifetimes. The fact that, in the years to come, I would become someone different from the 17-year-old who had struck a bargain with him at the bottom of a ravine to save the life of his mother. I'd have other life stories to tell him later. And when he realized that, if that bothered him, if he was insulted by being manipulated, I'd sympathize with him, of course. Because no one likes being manipulated. But maybe he'd also enjoy the fact that I'd had enough foresight to think of it in the first place. After school sometimes, Jared and I would go to Mosquito Lake, the first place I'd taken him when he came back to Temperance, when he came back to help me remember myself. And we'd look out at the small gray waves, rocking and rocking. Beneath those waves was an old coal mining village, with a schoolhouse and a church, and the tiny houses of the workers who used to live there. You never imagine all of that was down there if you didn't already know about it. The past is like that, really. If you don't know it, it's hard to imagine what's come before you. The future, I started to think, was kind of like that too. Hard to imagine because we don't know it. And even though I could know the future if I wanted to, just by closing my eyes and willing it, I'd made a decision not to look into mine too often. I wanted to be just here, in this life of mine. To live it just like anyone. We'd sit on the railing, or on one of the flat rocks down near the water, looking out at the rocking waves, talking about our past, talking about our future, our hands linked together. Between us, we had the present, and we were not surprised at all to be happy with that. To be happy with now. To be happy with nothing more than now.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Wonders of the Invisible World, written by Christopher Barzak, narrated by Michael Crouch. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2015 by Christopher Barzak. Production copyright 2015 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.